So far, at least 40 countries have detected the COVID Omicron variant within their borders, including here in the United States.
This variant is a cause for concern, not a cause for panic. We have the best vaccine in the world, the best medicines, the best scientists, and we're learning more every single day. And we'll fight this variant with scientific and knowledgeable actions and speed, not chaos and confusion.
President Biden last week on November 29th. Just 5 days earlier, South Africa first reported the Omicron variant, or B11529 as it's formally known, to the WHO. The first South African sample dates to November 9th. But there's emerging evidence that the variant had been widely circulating elsewhere in the world well before detection in South Africa. However, rather than supporting South Africa for its transparency, international governments, including the Biden administration, responded with travel restrictions.
The very day the World Health Organization identified the new variant, I took immediate steps to restrict travel from countries in Southern Africa. But while we have that travel restrictions can slow the speed of Omicron, it cannot prevent it. But here's what it does. It gives us time. It gives us time to take more actions, to move quicker, to make sure people understand you have to get your vaccine.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. South Africa presents a compelling case for the efficacy of comprehensive disease surveillance and the deadly downsides of disinformation. On the one hand, the country's sophisticated genomic sequencing system led it to first identify the Omicron variant. On the other hand, vaccination rates have been lagging there too, in part because of disinformation originating in the United States. And then there's the world's response to South Africa. Why respond first with a travel ban? This isn't March 2020, after all. So what, if anything, has the world learned about intelligently managing the first wave of news and nervousness with every new chapter in the COVID story? Well, that's what we're going to talk about today. And we begin with Professor Salim Abdul Karim. He's a professor for global health at Columbia University and former co-chair of South Africa's Ministerial Advisory Committee on COVID-19. And he joins us from Durban, South Africa. Professor Abdul Karim, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Hello, Meghna. It's a great pleasure to be with you here today.
Professor, I wonder if you might just start with giving us the picture right now in South Africa of the spread of the Omicron variant and how it's changed, if at all, the face of the pandemic in South Africa.
Sure. I think it's important to just take a step back and recognize that in South Africa, we had anticipated that we would get a new variant, and we anticipated that it would occur somewhere early in December because we have a very cyclical pattern to our waves. And so the predictions, in fact, at a commission of inquiry that I gave evidence, I said that we should expect a fourth wave in December and that it'll have a new variant, and that our government has invested very heavily in the genomic sequencing to identify the new variant as soon as it's available. So we had prepared for this. This is not something that we were just caught out with. We were ready. We were looking for new variants, and that's partly why we found one. When we identified the new variant, we also, at that stage, just saw the early increases in the number of cases. Mm-hmm. And if you go back 3 weeks from now and look at the cases, we were at about 200 to 300 cases per day. By the time we actually discovered and reported the variant, we were at about 1,000 cases per day. And of course, the latest data we have is that we're now at about 16,500 cases per day. So what we have seen in this very short space of time is a rapid increase in the number of cases. The doubling time is at this point about 1.5 days.
Right.
So it's giving you some idea of the rapidity with which this virus is spreading in our province, which is now the epicenter. And we've compared that to our previous waves, driven by the Beta variant and driven by the Delta variant. And the Omicron variant wave is faster than anything we saw with Beta and Delta.
So Professor Abdul Karim, if I may just step in here for a moment. This is one of the great joys of talking with someone who's as knowledgeable as you are. I have so many questions to ask. So first of all, what you just said, to be clear to listeners, there's obviously clear evidence in the numbers that you just shared of Omicron's infectiousness, because the doubling time being just basically 36 hours, which is quite remarkable. But I did want to also ask you, number of cases. I wonder, it's an important metric, but is it the most important metric for the general population to know? Because I'm also seeing that at least at this moment, the first evidence of the dangers of Omicron, the severity of the disease that people get if they are infected with this variant, may be less than with Delta.
Yeah, so we use four different markers. We use the number of cases, we use the test positivity rate, we use the number of admissions, and we use the number of deaths. And in deaths, we count both reported deaths and excess deaths. So we use all four markers to give us an overall picture of where we are. And no matter which way you look at it, right now, we are seeing a rapid increase in numbers, a rapid increase in test positivity, a rapid increase in admissions. But we are not seeing an increase in deaths just yet, which is expected. The deaths normally lag by about 2 weeks or so. So that's where our situation is. So we can say with some degree of confidence at this early stage that it is likely that Omicron has the ability to be highly transmissible, as you point out, highly infectious.
Okay. Now, I want to go back to something you said earlier, because it was absolutely remarkable that in South Africa, public health experts such as you, given the previous waves of the pandemic, were able, in fact, to predict the emergence of this fourth wave almost down to the very week that it occurred. Just a couple of weeks ago. I mean, you said you had identified the beginning of December as that time. What has South Africa learned about the pandemic that allowed for that kind of accurate prediction?
Well, it's actually just high school mathematics,
okay.
Nothing more than that. We have a substantial team of, over a dozen highly specialized mathematical modelers who model the epidemic and, do these predictions and so on. From my side, it was very simple. When I look at the gap between our waves, they are pretty consistent. They are between 94 and 99 days. So if you work with the upper limit of 99 days and you take the end of our third wave and add 99 days, that gives you the 2nd of December. So in August, I said we should expect we'll have a fourth wave on the 2nd of December. And on the 2nd of December, we reached the threshold to declare the fourth wave. Mm. So you can do that. It's nothing special about it. It's just high school mathematics.
Well, I suppose out of just a minor act of self-defense here, I will say that having sophisticated mathematical modelers may be a tad bit more than high school mathematics. But at least here in the United States, I don't know, maybe the sophisticated pandemic modeling is done in high school in South Africa. But Professor Abdul Karim in Durban, if you can just stand by for a moment, I want to bring in Vicky Bailey, who's with us from Sandton, South Africa. She's senior scientist at the Wits Vaccines and Infectious Diseases Analytics Statistics Research Unit. Vicky Bailey, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so you just heard Professor Abdul Karim talk about the 94 to 99 day gap between waves in South Africa. My first question to you is, that seems remarkably regular. Is that something that you would expect from a pandemic or epidemic disease? Have you seen that before?
We do see it in other respiratory viruses as well. We see that they are very cyclical in nature, and you can, to some degree, predict them reasonably well. So, yes, and that is what we have seen so far for SARS-CoV-2, is it is relatively predictable here in South Africa.
Okay. So I want to spend quite a bit of time with both of you learning and hearing about the disease surveillance system in South Africa. We've just got about a minute before our first break here. But Vicky, I wonder if you could just give us an overview. So how comprehensive is the disease surveillance system in the country and why?
It's very comprehensive. We also have a lot of back history of doing surveillance here in South Africa in terms of TB and multi-drug resistant TB, as well as HIV. So we've been doing surveillance on all these other infectious pathogens long before COVID-19 came along. And that really put us in good stead to carry on now that we've got this pandemic.
And when we say surveillance, we mean genomic sequencing of samples. What does surveillance specifically mean?
Yes, so genomic sequencing as well as contact tracing, research in general. We've got a really strong research background between the different research units and universities that work together nicely to make sure that we get the data out as quickly as possible.
Okay, so when we come back, we're going to talk about exactly how that happened with the Omicron variant and specifically what drew your attention and Professor Abdul Karim's attention to Gauteng province, if I said that correctly. But we'll hear all about that story when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are hearing the story of COVID in South Africa and whether the world's response to South Africa's announcement of the discovery of the Omicron variant, whether the world's response to that tells us if we've learned a lot or very little on how to handle new news about this pandemic. And I'm joined today from Durban, South Africa. Professor Salim Abdul Karim is with us. And from Sandton, South Africa, Vicky Bailey joins us as well. And I'd love to hear the story from both of you. And Vicky, I'll start with you about exactly how Omicron was detected in South Africa. And I want to just reiterate to listeners that detection does not equal origin. It's not origination. It's just detection. And we'll talk about why that's important in a moment. But Professor Abdul Karim had said earlier there was an uptick of cases in a particular province. So Vicky, tell me what happened after that, that led to the discovery or the announcement of the Omicron variant.
So a lot of the laboratories here in South Africa use a specific PCR test, which looks for three different regions within the genome of SARS-CoV-2, one of which is the spike protein. And just due to the massive amounts of mutations that we're detecting in the spike protein, we saw that these PCR assays for the spike protein weren't working, which highlighted to us that there was something going on in this region that we hadn't necessarily seen before. And that obviously then went on to the sequencing to make sure what was going on. And this S gene fallout, as it's called, or the spike protein fallout, was seen in multiple labs across Gauteng, And that led to increase in the number of sequencing that was going on and the identification of the new variant.
Mm. And so just to be clear about ultimately how many of the samples from Gauteng province showed signs of this anomalous PCR result?
It started off slowly, but it picked up really, really incredibly quickly. And at the moment, even in today's testing, every single sample that we have tested is now has this S gene fallout. So it's taken over incredibly quickly from when we first started picking up just literally weeks ago.
And then, Professor, Vicky Bailey, let me ask you one more question. I hope this doesn't sound trite, but I just am authentically curious. I mean, were you surprised? I don't know if anything is surprising anymore in this pandemic, but maybe just even the number of mutations in that spike protein. What were your first thoughts when that information was emerging?
We know that this virus was going to mutate. It wasn't unexpected, and we knew that it was going to keep on mutating in the spike protein. So it wasn't unexpected, but yes, the number of mutations, it really is. It feels like it is mutating exponentially. So it wasn't that big of a surprise, but at the same time, when you sequence it and you actually see the constellation of mutations, it's scary.
Hmm. Well, Professor Abdul Karim, Tulio de Oliveira, the director of the Center for Epidemic Response and Innovation at Stellenbosch University in South Africa, he gave a really interesting quick interview to the New Yorker magazine here in the United States. And there's something that he said I want to ask you about. He said, quote, "We were very surprised to see the variant emerge in a place with the highest population immunity in the country." What's the significance of that?
Yeah, I'm not sure what population immunity he's talking about. Maybe he's talking about SARS-CoV-2. So if we look at serological surveys, they suggest that somewhere in the region of 70% or so of South Africans have been exposed to the virus. But when we first described the beta variant, we knew at that stage that the mutations in the beta variant were not conferring protection. The previous infections that people had, that when they were exposed to the beta variant, they were not protected. So beta variant had the ability to bypass natural immunity from the previous and past infections. So we've already been through this. And in fact, in a study that Vicky's group did, they showed that the infection rates due to beta variant in those who'd had past infection, those who didn't have past infection, were similar. So we were expecting that the new variant, in order to really get a foothold in South Africa, it would have to be able to bypass existing natural immunity, because if it can't, it won't actually get a foothold. So it's not unexpected that Omicron has the ability to bypass natural immunity.
I see. And I do think that that's what he was referring to in terms of population immunity. Vicky Bailey, did you want to add to that? Because science is moving fast these days. So in the recent week or so, has there been any insight into whether Omicron can successfully evade vaccine-mediated immunity?
I think right now the data is still very new, in people treated, as well as people who've been during the Delta and the Beta wave. We are still really hopeful that most of those breakthroughs are very mild infections, but we need to wait and see and get that data.
Okay. So then let me ask you both very, very quickly, and then I'll turn to the deeper question of vaccinations in South Africa. Sounds like someone else is on the line there. But Professor Abdul Karim, for the mostly American audience that's listening right now, what do you think is the most important thing they ought to know about the Omicron variant based on the experience that South Africa has had over the past couple of weeks?
Sure. I think when we think about a new variant, you know, we have, you know, three key questions that we want to ask and three less important questions. The three key questions are, does it spread faster? Second is, you know, is it more severe? And the third is, does it evade vaccines? And if we look at the answers to those questions, the data are pretty sparse, very preliminary, but we have some idea about what the early indications are. And the early indications are, yes, it spreads faster. We're not sure whether it's really faster than Delta, but it's if it isn't, it's pretty close. The second is, it seems from the early evidence, and it's very preliminary because they're largely younger people that have been admitted, that we have milder clinical presentation. I wouldn't make too much of that because severe illness is normally at a later stage of COVID-19. But at this stage, we don't really have any red flags as far as clinical presentation and severity is concerned. The third is we just don't know about whether it evades vaccine immunity. The mutations that the variant has is likely to confer some level of immune escape from antibody protection. But the extent of that and what net effect that would have, we don't yet know. So those are the critical pieces of information, the evidence that we have. From the minor point of view, people want to do the diagnostics work. Do our public health prevention mechanisms work? Mm-hmm. And lastly, you know, do our existing treatments work? And the answer to all of those is pretty much yes, they do.
So do I even dare wonder if so far how Omicron has presented itself as being, yes, looks like much more infectious, but at this point in time, perhaps not as harmful or deadly, severe, I should say. You know, is this the first glimmer in how pandemics may eventually burn out? Because the pathogens continuously mutate and evolve. But do they sometimes evolve towards, this more endemic state where they're no longer as severe or harmful?
I think because each new variant has to compete with the variant that went before it, it has to have some advantage over the previous variant. Because if it doesn't have that advantage, it won't really be able to take a foothold and become as dominant as the previous variant. Now, Delta variant was a pretty well-adapted variant in that it was able to spread quickly, and that's how it, you know, infected pretty much the whole world. And it was able to do so because it caused a higher level of virus, what we call a viral load in the nose and throat. And studies in China show that it's up to about 1,000-fold higher. And the second is that you are infectious for a longer period. But we didn't see any difference in the clinical presentation that was meaningful. Now, we think that generally viruses will mutate and the ones that have the most advantages will begin to take a foothold and all the others just by natural selection will peter out. But one of the things is that for a virus to adapt and to be more competitive against its past variant, generally, it needs people to spread it more easily. And so a virus that's going to cause a lot of illness, where people are now going to stay at home or be in hospital and not spread it to other people walking around, you know, going in public transport, then the variant has fewer advantages in that case. So generally, you would expect that new variants would move in the general direction of being less severe. That's part of the evolutionary process. And at this stage, not clear if Omicron's going in that direction. The indications are suggesting that. But, you know, it's early days.
Interesting. Well, I mean, and it's early days for Omicron, but back in January, February, March of 2020, I mean, it was the novel coronavirus, right? Which is what gave rise to the pandemic, and it's not so novel anymore. Well, so let's turn a little bit here to talk about the other part of the story of the pandemic right now in South Africa, because about 25% of South Africans are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. And that low number is due in part to issues of supply and also in more rural places, the requirement for ultra cold storage for vaccines. That's always been part of the picture. But there is another issue too, a familiar one. It's vaccine hesitancy.
A lot of the things that we're seeing coming out now about the COVID vaccines, we have actually seen for other vaccines in the past. It's just now with COVID vaccines, obviously, rolling out a vaccine to an entire population is something that we've actually never really had to do before.
That's Sarah Downs, a research fellow at the University of Witwatersrand, and she goes under the alias Mistress of Science online, where she helps combat vaccine misinformation.
So say, for example, if you're not worried about the side effects like headaches, etc., there's a lot of misinformation, for example, about fertility. And this we saw with the HPV vaccine. And vaccines absolutely can't affect fertility, but still these things go around.
So where is that misinformation coming from? Well, Downs says the West.
It's almost like a lot of conspiracies are exported to other countries. As an example, there's Dr. Carey, I'm sure you know who that is, but she had done a video about live blood analysis and showing all sorts of things under a microscope. And, you know, it's so clear that she does not work with histology or microscopy or anything like that, because she's basically showing dust particles and lint and air bubbles and trying to claim they are what they're not. And then a couple of weeks, maybe a week later, we had a South African alternative medicine practitioner who was spreading the exact same things with the exact same type of misinformation and the same type of slides, etc. So almost like a copycat.
Now, when Downs mentioned Made earlier, she's referring to Carrie Made, a self-described osteopathic physician who claimed she found living organisms in sterile COVID-19 vaccines. Now, Downs says, here's what people should first consider whenever they see questionable information online.
People need to really, really think about the politics surrounding this and look at it and say, okay, is this information that I'm being given, does it have a political motive? Does it make me unduly afraid? And then take a step back and kind of assess the information and not share it. I think that's maybe the biggest thing.
Sarah Downs is a research fellow at the University of Witwatersrand. Vicky Bailey, you're also part of Team HALO, a UN-backed initiative to fight vaccine misinformation online. Can you tell us how much a role disinformation has played in South Africa?
Yes, I think it's a lot more than we were initially expecting. Whenever you try and get the correct information out, you always have people who come back and say, you're being paid by Big Pharma, seems to be the big one. And then a lot of people querying the vaccines and how quickly we develop them. So there's a lot of misinformation within the community, and it's incredible how quickly it's spread here in South Africa. And it really has prevented us from rolling out the vaccine to the extent that we wanted to. So, and it's everywhere. It's all on the social media platforms. The moment you get on there, and any of us, any of the guides from all over the world, the moment we share any information, they're immediately all of the trolls just querying the information and saying it's wrong and that sort of thing. So it's definitely widespread, and it is worldwide.
Hmm. Can you tell us more? Is that happening kind of across South Africa, or are there some locations that are more susceptible to hesitancy because of the disinformation?
It seems to be everywhere. So definitely in the more urban communities that have access to information, you would have thought it would be lower, but it's not. I think, unfortunately, information isn't necessarily king. And then we even see it when you go into the more rural communities where they might not have access to social media and that sort of thing. Word of mouth still plays a massive role. And it just takes one person saying that they had an adverse event or that a family member had an adverse event, even though there's absolutely no information that it's linked to the vaccine, that information will spread so quickly within these very small villages to the point where nobody will then want to get vaccinated.
Hmm. Well, Vicky Bailey, senior scientist at the VITS Vaccines and Infectious Diseases Analytics Research Unit and also part of Team HALO, a UN-backed initiative to fight COVID vaccine misinformation. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Professor Salim Abdul-Karim, stand by for just a moment. We'll talk a lot more about the world's response to the Omicron variant when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we're joined today by Professor Salim Abdul-Karim. He's a professor for global health at Columbia University and also former co-chair of South Africa's Ministerial Advisory Committee on COVID-19. He's with us from Durban, South Africa, and he's helping us listen and learn to the story South Africa has to tell about the COVID pandemic right now, about the benefits of comprehensive disease surveillance, which we talked about, which allowed South Africa to first identify the Omicron variant, but also the downsides of misinformation and disinformation about the pandemic, and also what the global community has learned, if anything, about how to respond to new information and new waves of the pandemic. So on that front, as we said a little bit earlier, one of the first things that happened after South Africa first identified the Omicron variant was a lot of other nations said, well, they were going to introduce travel bans. So here's Dr. Naheed Bhadelia. She's the founding director of the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases Policy and Research at Boston University. And she says the Biden administration here in the United States made the wrong move when quickly introducing that travel ban from South Africa.
The goal of blunt travel bans at most may be to slow the transmission. It's not going to stop it. And so instead, I think that what makes sense is to sort of recognize that, you know, those variants may be in multiple places, and hence we need to take a science-based approach to travel restrictions if we do want to slow it, and by introducing the same type of travel requirements for everybody coming into the country. And as we now know, because there are already cases in multiple states in the United States, between states as well.
Bhadelia says countries have been beholden or required, I should say, to share this type of medical information since the 1850s during cholera outbreaks. And currently, the World Health Organization says any disease threat, such as a new variant discovered within a country's borders, must be reported within 48 hours.
We need that, right? Because we want to sound the alarm and act quickly. But every time a country does that, they face this potential that there will be a backlash and travel and trade will stop. And if it turns out to be nothing, they have just suffered immense amount of economic, you know, fallout. And so there is a hesitation. We've seen this not just in the setting of SARS-CoV-2, but, you know, in the past, in many countries, you've seen this slight hesitation of how do you report out potential threats when, you know, there might be just irrational response on the other end from a lot of other parts of the world.
That irrational response. Well, as a result, the reality is often that countries like South Africa, which comply with international disease surveillance agreements, are unduly punished.
What people need to recognize is that detection is not the same as origination. Detection generally is a function of both presence of a threat, but also how good you are at actually finding it in the first place. And so we should, instead of sort of punishing the country that detects it, you know, I think that we should commend it, we should support the countries, and we should take a humanitarian perspective to recognizing that, you know, that other countries' populations may be hurt from blunt travel bans, which may not benefit us as much, knowing how these viruses work.
That's Dr. Naheed Bedelia, founding director of the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases Policy and Research at Boston University. Well, Professor Abdul Karim in Durban, can you tell us a little bit more about that very narrow window of time, that 48 hours that countries have to report to the WHO any new information about a variant, a previously unidentified variant? I mean, how did that that 48 hours play out in South Africa?
Well, it's quite interesting. So initially, there was a technician in a private laboratory that identified the first six patients where, as Vicky described, there was this S gene dropout and proceeded to do sequencing on those. And then when they saw the sequence, they realized it was unusual. And so the head of the laboratory, somebody called Alison Glass, contacted the NICD to inform our National Institute for Communicable Diseases. And when that happened, they informed the national consortium that does the genomic surveillance. And so when the national consortium received the sequence, this was on Tuesday, 2 weeks ago. Professor D'Oliveira called it up on his screen, and he was quite surprised. So he ran up to my office, he's one floor below me, and said, "You have to come and look at this." I go downstairs, and I don't know what I was expecting. But when I saw the sequence, I said, "You've got to be kidding." I was aghast. The number of mutations, I mean, I couldn't even count them. There were that many. But straight away, I saw 484 was a mutation, 417. I mean, all the mutations that are really quite important in some of the other variants. So on Tuesday, the critical thing was to verify the sequences. And so a decision was taken straight away to sequence 100 samples within 24 hours. And that's what was done. And once that was verified, we had, I think, 76 of the 100 were this new variant, 529. And so the WHO was informed on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, the Minister of Health was informed, and you know that's when the announcement was eventually made. So literally, from the genomic team getting the first samples to the time the public announcement was made was just about 3 days, 4 days at most. So, you know, we wanted to give the whole world a very early warning, you know, rather than to, you know, sit on that information. And I think the price that came with it was a lesson for us, because it certainly will be a lesson to every other country that if they do discover a variant, they will think twice about announcing it too quickly. They might as well sit on it and wait for let some other country make the announcement to avoid the repercussions that we've had to deal with.
Is there any rational reason now that you can think of regarding this pandemic, for any kind of hard travel ban?
I think there is a small benefit that comes from a travel ban, and that's relating to how well you seed the new variant. And so if you allow completely unfettered travel, you may seed it to a greater extent. But the benefit, if any, is marginal. And the reason for that is we have really good ways now, and we use the five, you know, key strategies to prevent or reduce the risk of travel transmissions. You know, we make sure that only vaccinated people fly or travel by sea. We make sure they have a negative test when they leave. We make sure they got no symptoms, that they wear their masks during their entire travel, and then they are tested on arrival. So those five things together will, you know, identify 99.9% of all of the cases, as we have seen. So the travel ban over and above that really has a negligible benefit. But the harm is what's important, because when you identify a new global threat, we need to be able to stand together in tackling the threat. The last thing you want is to say to another country, don't come anywhere near us. We don't want you anywhere near us, and we're not coming to anywhere near you. So building, you know, fences like that, when we should be building bridges, is the real harm that's done, because it's preventing us from standing together to take up the challenge of a new variant. Mm.
I want to come back to the point you're making, because it's very important, in just a moment. But I, you know, earlier in the show, we talked about high school math. I feel like it's now high school biology to understand that, especially for a pathogen like SARS-CoV-2, in which so many cases are asymptomatic, that 21 months into a pandemic, when a nation with excellent disease surveillance that has the ability and capacity to move quickly when there's an interesting new hotspot, but even if in that case, when the variant is identified, shouldn't we just automatically assume that it's probably well outside the point of identification anyway? I'm failing to understand what the logic is from a pandemic control point of view to think, well, it's going to stop Omicron if we stop travel from Southern Africa, because within days we were starting to get, you know, stories from Europe and elsewhere of cases that they were backdating that might be much earlier than what the first cases in South Africa.
Yeah, I think, Magna, you have really hit it on the head. I think the travel bans are more about political theater. They are more about saying, I'm doing something, even though it's not going to be particularly effective. Because by the time we identified a case in South Africa, it's probably been spreading for a good 6-8 weeks or even longer. Because for us to pick it up means that, you know, a certain threshold of infections has occurred that we would be able to pick it up in surveillance. So this is not something that you can say, okay, it's something completely new, we don't have it, because the truth is it's already spread into many countries long before we have identified it.
Professor Abdul Karim, can you tell me a little bit more, just briefly, how would you describe the other harms that you're talking about, that these blunt travel bans as a first response to South Africa's news? What other harms have been done in South Africa because of that?
So I think the first is the one I've already mentioned, which is that the whole thing about, you know, trying to solve global problems as a global community, and travel bans undermine that. They create suspicion, distrust, and they do something else, is that they create a them and us. Mm. And that those people are the lepers. And I've dealt with that in HIV. You know, we wouldn't allow kids to go to school because they had HIV. We wouldn't allow, the US didn't allow anybody with HIV to travel to the US for many years. So we've seen how this is done and the harm that it causes, but it does more than that. What it does is that it undermines our ability to get some important things. And we depend on the courier flights in order to, deliver important reagents and research materials and things that we need. And you know, the flights literally stopped occurring because they were worried about the crew landing in South Africa, and that when they went back home, they would have to go into quarantine. So they didn't want to do that, so they just stopped flying here. In addition, we are heavily dependent for flights, especially to Europe, for some of our economic activities. For example, flowers. Flowers, we are a major exporter of flowers, and those are all delivered by flight into various routes that go into Europe. And so when those flights all stopped, that put paid to our flower industry, and they can't keep flowers and export it next month. You know, basically, we're compromising their livelihoods. So it's got a lot of impact that, you know, affects the person on in the street, the scientists and universities, you know, and the whole nation in terms of its psyche and how we want to view ourselves and how other countries view us.
And perhaps further inflaming that distrust that can then, you know, feed into maybe also the distrust of the vaccines as well. I mean, it's a terrible negative feedback loop. It just, you know, what you're describing here to me, I'll admit, just as an individual citizen of the world, it's rather frustrating because it seems like politically the global community is behaving as if it's learned nothing over the past 20 months, politically still sort of groping around in the dark to try to do something, anything, at every new bit of news about or every new sort of understanding about how SARS-CoV-2 is changing. That is frustrating. So in the last couple of minutes that we have, Professor Abdul-Karim, what should have been the global community's response? What response would you like to see next time that actually helps move us all worldwide forward in trying to bring this pandemic to a close?
I think I would say three things. The first is that, you know, it shouldn't just be South Africa was expecting a variant. It should be the whole world's expecting a variant. Every country should be expecting a variant. That's the nature of this virus. There are variants that are created, and we should expect them to drive new waves and to drive, you know, the rise in cases. So we should all expect it, have the surveillance to identify it, and that we should always be prepared for a new variant. And the second is that when a new variant emerges, the key critical thing is to try and deal with the uncertainty, because that's what scares people, that they're uncertain and they worry that if they don't act, even though it might not do any good, they worry because they are so uncertain. But you know, when there were several countries that simply contacted us and said, you know, can you just give us an understanding of what it is that we're dealing with here? And we can explain that, because we know many of the mutations, they are in other variants, and we've dealt with variants many times before. We dealt with beta, we dealt with delta, so we can deal with a new variant. Yeah. So I think sharing that information was important. And the third, I think,
we just have a few seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, is that, you know, we got to ensure we create a set of rules by which we share information. Thanks.
Share information and not overreact as well, because of the harms that that does, as you said earlier. Well, Professor Salim Abdul-Karim, former co-chair of South Africa's Ministerial Advisory Committee on COVID-19, with us today from Durban. Thank you so very much for joining us, Professor.
It's an absolute pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.